This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Carl Fogel on the death of his friend and collaborator, Aaron Swartz.
Carl's article opens by saying, "We lost one of the smartest, most politically aware, and most dedicated advocates for freedom we have had so far in the internet age."
We congratulate Ramsey Clark on his 85th birthday and listen to the speech he gave at the birthday party held for him up at Riverside Church in early January.
Ramsey went from a cushy job as the Attorney General of the United States to taking on the causes of those oppressed by the United States, from the Vietnamese to the Iranians and to others all over the world.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights. For those of you who may be unaware of who Aaron Swartz was, there's been a lot out there. He was one of the founders of something called the RSS feed, which is a way of getting information out over the internet. He was a co-founder of the site Reddit. He ran an organization called Demand Progress, and he was a coordinator of the successful efforts to ensure that the Stop Online Piracy Act did not become law. Sadly, and probably a major contributing factor in his suicide, was the indictment in Boston for which he faced 35 years. The indictment charged that Aaron had illegally uploaded, if that's the word, or downloaded 4.8 million documents from a site called JSTOR, which stores academic articles. Aaron apparently was doing that for his own research and was authorized to have access to that computer. It was a case of clear overcharging, a case in which the prosecutors insisted on charging him with crimes that could get 35 years. It was one in which they offered a lower plea, but they insisted on his pleading to felonies. Aaron was an incredibly principled person, refused to ever plead to a felony. 2 days after the prosecutors refused to dismiss the charges or presumably take a misdemeanor or something else, Aaron Swartz committed suicide. This is Michael Ratner speaking, and I want to say something personal about Aaron Swartz. I didn't know him well, not as well as many other people, particularly in the internet free information world, knew Aaron. I got the news of Aaron's death on January 11th, 2013, as I was just finishing a discussion I was having with the audience on Aaron Swartz. At the time when I heard of his death, I was in Miami and I was giving a talk to a group of people who were there for the 11th anniversary of Guantanamo. And after I finished my talk, someone knew I represented Julian Assange, and they asked me, what did I know about Julian's case, et cetera. And in talking about Julian's case, I said, there's some real internet heroes out there. There's Jeremy Hammond. There's Bradley Manning. There's Julian Assange. And I mentioned Aaron Swartz. I sat down in my chair afterwards. I looked at my BlackBerry, and there was a note. Really, within seconds after I said that, from a close friend of Aaron's, really almost someone who was like a stepfather in ways for Aaron, that said, "Michael, I just heard the devastating news. Aaron Swartz committed suicide." I basically cried for the next 3 days. I'd met him only briefly. It was in a way to help him think about his legal case, to give him advice on how to really try and persuade MIT to come out publicly to say he should not be charged. At Aaron's funeral on January 15th in Chicago, and in a statement that his father and his family issued after Aaron's death, they didn't mince words about who is responsible for Aaron's suicide. Here's what his father said at the funeral. "Aaron did not commit suicide, but was killed by the government." There were a lot of failures here. Two of the main ones being MIT, and there's an investigation now that they've launched on themselves. Of course, it's too late for Aaron Swartz. And there was, of course, the incredible failure of the U.S. attorney
in Boston, and her acolytes, the assistant U.S. attorneys, who really, I think, for career reasons, wanted to push this case way beyond where it should have gone. And what Aaron's case represents, as well as all a lot of these other internet cases represent, is government and corporate control over the information that you and I ought to have a right to read. So as we go forward and hear an extraordinary interview with an acquaintance of Aaron, Carl Fogel, think that and think how important our access to internet information is. Carl Fogel, as I said, has worked with Aaron in the past, has a website called questioncopyright.org. And if you go to that website, you'll see an important article that Carl wrote called Remembering Aaron Swartz, with many links to what Aaron's work was and what others have said about Aaron. It's a very sad, really sad, not just obviously for Aaron, Aaron's partner, his family, but for all of us who cared about Aaron and who cared about the idea that information and access to knowledge should be for all of us, not just for those who can pay. Carl Fogel, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Carl, you know, we're here at this sad point a few days after Aaron Swartz died. And can you give our listeners some sense of who was Aaron Swartz?
Yeah, although that's surprisingly for someone 26 years old, there's a lot to give. I mean, there's a lot of background. He did a lot of things. He was a... he's going to be portrayed, has been portrayed as a kind of technical whiz kid, genius who sort of knew how the internet worked and was able to hack into things. That's not actually who Aaron was, and that's not even really accurate, although he was a very good programmer. He was a very precocious and very technically adept person who started doing significant work on internet standards and access to information and moving information around communications networks at an early age, at 13. And the reason that he was able to do this was that he started participating using electronic means like chat rooms and email and things in some of these standards bodies to help develop a particular set of standards that made transmitting information on the World Wide Web a little bit easier. And they didn't know that he was 13 or 14 until the first time they held an in-person conference, and he, you know, sort of had, I guess he had to get his parents' permission to show up, and one of his parents called the conference organizer and said, well, okay, we're going to, you know, our son's going to go, but you got to know he's 14. and I don't know the details of this. It was alluded to it, in a much sadder context at his funeral yesterday, but, you know, nobody knew that he was this kid because his writing was so mature. He was by that point already very widely read and very able to express himself. And apparently, which I didn't realize was true even from then, although I knew it was true later, he was very good at getting people to cooperate on a goal and sort of getting them each to contribute their piece and keeping a larger vision in mind. He was a very good organizer of people who were themselves rather sort of high-powered internet standards makers. And this was noticed by the conference organizers, and that's why they were so surprised when he turned out to be a kid.
Now, I guess in looking at the little bit I pick up, which is general about his life, you know, you see this list of things, which you could tell me what you think is the highlights, and then also what he had a political view about a lot of this. And, you know, you see the RSS feed, Reddit, Demand Progress, his opposition to SOPA, and then Creative Commons. So I guess those are what, like, for people like me who are outsiders, are highlights of at least some of what Aaron did. And then there's the politics of what he believed in, which I think some of that belief you share as well.
Very much. And actually, interestingly, I know that some of the things you just listed are probably acronyms to some of the listeners and nothing more. For RSS, a really simple syndication format, is a means of having a website notify people via a very efficient and timely sort of information push mechanism when updates go on that website.
So like when I get a New York Times update, at least at one time that would have been based on an RSS feed, is that right?
Right, and there are various methods of doing this. RSS is still used. It's not as popular now as it used to be, I think. At least I seem to have noticed that it's often not on newer websites. But at the time, it was very important, and it sort of set a minimum standard for websites giving real-time notification outward to subscribers as to when new content appeared, and so that, you know, the things that have replaced it used that as a baseline for, well, we can't do any worse than this.
Now, Aaron was one of the people who developed that, I guess. Is that right?
Yes, he developed that standard, or helped develop that standard, was a major contributor to it. But the reason I was explaining RSS, people might not know what it is, and they probably have heard of some of the other things. The Stop Online Piracy Act, which was essentially a clampdown on websites that provide access to information in ways that terms of service or certain, rather, in my opinion, restrictive laws, and in Aaron's opinion, don't permit. Creative Commons is an organization that promotes much looser and more permissive copyright regulations and gives authors and creators of content tools like more liberal licenses to release their content under. All of these things that he did, we're leaving out a huge amount here, maybe we'll get to talk about it later, had one thing in common, which was giving people access to knowledge, making it easier for people to get information from the internet, information that is often artificially restricted. I mean, the internet, the wires of the internet are perfectly willing to carry any piece of information. When they don't, it's only because a human somewhere has decided we're going to block access. And this isn't about privacy. He's not talking about, like, quote-unquote, liberating people's personal medical records or something like that, or their psychiatrist's records. He's talking about access to scholarly articles that were funded by taxpayer dollars and things like that.
One of the things I mentioned was Reddit and Demand Progress. And can you just talk about those for a second, what those are?
Yeah. Reddit is a – I'm going to give very, very capsule explanations to leave us time, and I think the general idea is – only what's needed here. You could think of Reddit as I don't know, this comparison might have annoyed him, I don't know, a kind of early Facebook in the sense that it gave people a surface, an online surface on which to post things that were interesting to them and then comment on things that were posted. So it's sort of a collaborative area where people who don't know each other and might not interact repeatedly can still form conversations around particular topics, usually starting with a news article or a post or a video or something on the internet. He actually, I think the history is that he was a founder or co-founder of something called Infogami, which then emerged very early on with Reddit. So he essentially was one of the founders or very, very early and influential people at Reddit, which is continues to be a very important site for shared conversations on the internet. Creative Commons, we just talked about in a moment, Demand Progress, I think, is the one we haven't talked about. That was an organization that he helped start that organized a massive online protest around SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act, which was, I think it's practically an objective fact to call it an egregious and needless law. I mean, it was really just sort of a handout to very restrictive content industry lobbyists and companies. That, if you remember sort of the day the internet went dark, so a lot of sites sort of blacked out their front pages. Wikipedia did it, Creative Commons did it, many sites, my own did as well. And on their front page, in this black background, there was just a very short explanation or a link saying, here is why we're protesting, and it's this law. And this internet-wide action really stopped the law dead in its tracks. All of a sudden, congressmen sort of pulled up short and said, well, hey, whoa, this is we thought we were just signing off onto a standard, you know, copyright industry protection bill, and this is actually enraging people much more than we realized, and it stopped it dead. It was over.
What role did Aaron have in doing that?
That I don't know his exact role. I mean, he worked with many people on that. It was one of the characteristics of him was that he was intensely collaborative. I mean, he was often an engine of what was moving, but I wasn't in that particular room, and I don't know if that, for example, that internet blackout idea was his or was someone else's. He probably played a role in making sure that it worked technically, that everyone had good, reliable code with which to black out the front page and point to the shared site that had an explanation of why we should be protesting SOPA. And he wrote very eloquently about why it was necessary to protest that and other restrictive laws. He produced a copy that people used, you know.
Carl, I want to move a little bit to his intersections with the law. But before that, you know, you have a site called questioncopyright.org. And obviously, there's some philosophy behind that site that you have. And I think there were like intersections with Aaron's philosophy as well. And so you can just tell us a little about that.
Yeah, and I don't want to go too deeply into our mission because I'd like to keep it focused on Aaron's beliefs, which I share. The questioncopyright.org's purpose, which I had discussed at length with Aaron, and he knew this history at least as well as I do, and probably more deeply because he read so much. It's basically founded to change the way debate about copyright law and copyright practices happen in the world, and especially in the U.S. Because if you talk to people about copyright and they haven't thought about it, they think things like, well, artists got to make a living, right? They'll say people shouldn't steal stuff and people should get credit for their work, none of which really has anything to do with copyright. It's not about attribution. It's not how most artists make a living. It's certainly not how most scholarly writers make a living, especially ones at universities. And it was really instituted initially as a kind of regulation to help support the publishing industry, and was lobbied for by the publishing industry 300 years ago. That's what created it. Aaron understood that, and he also understood that poor terms of debate, very poor framing, was causing us to have increasingly restrictive copyright laws in an age when we had this gigantic worldwide copying machine. I mean, he really grew up on the internet, and he understood its power, and it just really enraged him that we had the potential to share all human knowledge, especially scientific and technical and cultural knowledge, with every single person on the planet, and that we were blocking that.
What was next on my mind, I think, was intersection of Aaron and the law, but, you know, underlying that, I think the what's called, and probably most of our listeners don't know it, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, the CFAA. I mean, that's a place we could go next or wherever you'd like.
That's a great place to go next. That's one of many fairly recent, I mean recent as in the last 10 or 20 years, and copyright is of course much older than that, recent laws that basically attempt to make, I'm going to put it as baldly as I can, two parties privately sharing information with each other. It criminalizes that. And then it criminalizes obtaining information from sites that are apparently willing to give it out, because he downloaded a lot of articles from a web service called JSTOR. And, I mean, it was JSTOR's servers that made a copy of each article, and they sent it to Aaron's computer. These laws, what they do is they say, and I'm not in front of a computer right now, I don't have the exact wording, but they essentially make it so that sharing these things becomes criminal, that the penalties are very high. You know, you download a song or you share a few too many articles and you could be liable for thousands or, in Aaron's case, over $1 million. And then they're actually punishable by jail. So if you copy too much and you could go to jail, he was facing 35 years, remember, for scholarly articles. The other thing they do is that they're rather vaguely worded, and they're not just about copyright restrictions. They're about quote-unquote computer hacking. In the coverage of this case leading up to now, although the coverage has been getting better, sadly, since his death, he was always referred to as a hacker, meaning someone who sort of breaks in and does damage to computers or does some sort of harm. That's inaccurate. What these laws do is they say someone who knowingly uses a computer network to use someone else's server, someone else's computer, in a way that other person didn't intend. In other words, if you violate someone's terms of service, you know, every website has a terms of service agreement, and usually you click through it, like when you sign up for Facebook or something like that.
Yeah, we don't read them. Well, they're hundreds of pages long, and hit a thing at the end, right?
Because the organization running that site, they've got a whole department. They have a team of lawyers who wrote this thing that's incredibly long. It's not physically possible, even at the speed that Aaron read, which was very fast, you couldn't read all these terms of services and actually get anything done. Nobody can. So everyone clicks through, and half the time you don't have to click through. You don't technically even have to read them to get to the stuff. So making it so that using someone else's computer in a way that they might not have intended and might be in violation of a terms of service agreement that is you either didn't see or it was too long to read, making that criminalizable and punishable by jail is ridiculous, because you're essentially, that's the legislature's outsourcing the decision about what is criminality to private sector non-negotiated asymmetrical contracts that nobody even reads.
I think you wrote something about that, and I really thought that was smart, that it's basically criminalizing a contract violation and one that is, as we used to call in law school, an adherence contract. It's one-sided. You don't really, there's not much you can do about it.
Right. And of course, to get anything done on the internet today, it's not like you can stop agreeing to these contracts. You'd have to shut off your phone. You'd have to stop using a computer and using the internet because your internet service provider has a terms of service agreement with you, which you've probably violated, you know, at some time. So these, I mean, Aaron understood very well. He had actually read these laws, which is a very boring thing to do because they're long as these terms of service contracts. And he was just really trying hard to change the way legislators think about these restrictions and these laws and to not pass laws that essentially just hand the power of deciding when copying is a criminal act to corporations that are not going to use it well. And now we learn to prosecutors who are going to abuse it.
To me, the analogy is putting a meter on the sun, that they want to
make everything a
commodity and then sell it to you. And this huge pool of human culture, which should be available to everybody, is something they want to sell to you. And I think that underlay what Aaron was doing.
Yeah, he was opposed to artificial scarcity. You know, he didn't see why, when it's possible for everyone to have a copy. Anyone who wants to read a given article can have a copy of it. They don't interfere with each other. It's not like someone loses access when some new person gains access. And he understood that there was no scarcity here. And it deeply bothered him. It bothered his sense of justice that we were behaving as though there was a scarcity. And then I think it's important to realize that, I mean, he came from a very loving and well-educated family, but he also was largely self-taught in the sense that he just read whatever he wanted to read, and access to knowledge made him who he was, and he knew that. And he wanted that for everyone, I think.
Let's talk for a second about the indictment and the JSTOR story, which has been out there, but I think our listeners have to understand what he is alleged to have done, the fact that JSTOR didn't want to prosecute, and what MIT's role and the U.S. Attorney's role, and then, of course, what you heard at the funeral yesterday about that. Well, tell us about the indictment. I mean, it's one of those things that most people just say, well, you know, he just took some stuff illegally and, you know, they prosecuted him.
Right. Well, actually, we did a piece a couple of years ago when the indictment was new. And indeed, we examined, you know, like a bunch of headlines and coverage of the case. And it was always portrayed as young hacker steals millions of dollars of computer files from MIT or from JSTOR. It was always portrayed as a theft. And of course, the word hacker was in there, and it was the sense that he was this kind of loose, wild kid who was out to spray graffiti on people's scholarly articles or something like that, which, of course, is unrelated to the truth. It's just completely a lie. What the facts of the case are is that he wanted to download a lot of articles from JSTOR. Now, these articles were available for free from JSTOR. However, they put a limit on how many you could download from a given computer network address at a given time, in a given time period. And I think that was probably not so much to stop people from getting access to the articles as to avoid strain on their servers. I don't know exactly what the motivation for that limitation was. He found a technical way to work around it by getting into a networking closet where he was able to have a computer change its network address very quickly so that he would download, you know, 20 or 1,000 articles, and then he was getting close to JSTOR's imposed limit on the server side.
We're smiling when you say that because this seems so remarkable.
I've got to get Ratner to help me increase the ring volume on my BlackBerry here, so it's really quite amazing.
So he just would change the IP address, could keep changing. Is that it? So they would keep getting the articles.
It was a very errant move, right? There's no denying he engaged in some very mild and non-malicious subterfuge to do this. He snuck into a network closet. That network closet was unlocked, and MIT maintains famously a very open network because they want people to have access. And you know, other people had access to that network closet. It wasn't like he broke into anyone's house or something. He didn't. By the way, there's a very good rundown of the technical facts of the case in a post by Alex Stamos, Stamos, who was going to be an expert witness for the defense, and now he's just taken his sort of draft notes and posted them as an explanation of what Aaron did and didn't do. So So Aaron downloaded it. It was a huge number of articles in the millions, like 4.8 million or something.
Wow.
I can't remember the exact number. And got caught. And JSTOR said, I can't remember how he was caught. I think MIT might have noticed the extra network activity or a security camera or something caught him. So remember that the articles were being copied down from JSTOR, not from MIT. MIT was just the network intermediary. He was using MIT's networks to do it. So MIT, I believe, and adding these qualifications because I feel very bad about possibly accusing someone of doing something when I'm not absolutely sure they did it, but I believe that it was MIT who notified the police or the FBI. I think that JSTOR may have noticed independently the activity on their servers, or they found out about it from the FBI coming and contacting them. In any case, they didn't want to press charges. They did ask for, I don't really understand what this means. They asked for their articles back, but of course they never lost any articles. I guess what they wanted was for Aaron to delete his copies or something, and maybe he did that once he was under investigation. So at this point, the FBI steps in, and Computer Fraud and Abuse Act is a federal criminal law. So the prosecutors can go ahead and charge, and a U.S. Attorney's Office charged him with violating this act. JSTOR didn't want to press charges. MIT, as far as I know, while they cooperated with the investigation, did not have any charges to press. But they also didn't come out and make any public statements defending Aaron or saying, like, this wasn't theft. You know, he was doing this for access to knowledge. By the way, he wanted to use the articles for research purposes. He was doing research, apparently, it looks like he was doing research into the effect of funding on academic research, and he wanted to do it in a kind of big data approach. And so he needed like all these millions of articles in order to write programs to parse them and look for conclusions and funders and kind of do a gigantic database analysis of it. So it was in a very noble cause, actually. So I think it was very disappointing to him that the prosecutors wouldn't back down. It was very disappointing to him that MIT, an institution, a nonprofit institution of higher learning, wouldn't step up in his support. We learned at the funeral that the family and the defense lawyers had gone to MIT and specifically asked them to make a public statement, and had approached the prosecutors privately and begged them to reduce the charges or drop them, and just said, look, this is crazy. You're destroying a young man's life. Why are you doing this? They didn't know how it was going to end, but they did make that request in advance, and the prosecutors still refused, which, I mean, it makes me shake to... It makes me so angry to understand that they knew what they were doing, and they knew that what his Aaron's intentions were, and that he wasn't a thief, he wasn't any of the things they said, and they pressed ahead anyway because they had a big case, you know, that would make their reputations.
I think that's right.
The motivation they had.
I think the reputation.
It's just right. Yeah, their careers should be over. I know that's cruel to say, but they should go no further.
Well, Michael and I just signed a petition, and we're going to put it on our website at lawanddisorder.org, asking that this woman prosecutor in Boston's career be terminated.
Not just her. The specific, I mean, she was supervising, but there were at least two others who were really running the case. I realize the petition, the White House petition site, is for her removal, and I think that's justified.
Yeah.
But the others have something to answer.
Right.
For
there were two other. There were two other people. One was Steve Heyman, who was going for it, and another prosecutor who signed the superseding indictment I saw. So there was this indictment of 35 years he could serve. He didn't want to plead. I think he was very principled when I've talked to people about not pleading to a felony, particularly as he didn't feel he had done anything wrong.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you want to address this, but I know I read Lawrence Lessig's article about Aaron, which is quite moving. And then I read your piece, and people, you know, should look at it at your website, which is at questioncopyright.org. But you have a slight different nuance about looking at this case, maybe not just a nuance, from Lawrence Lessig. And can you just discuss, if you'd like, that difference?
I will, but I first want to say that, I mean, Lawrence Lessig is very widely and deservedly respected in this field. He's done a lot, from founding Creative Commons to legal arguments before courts and writing his books to help the free culture movement and to help the same causes Aaron believed in. So this, and he spoke very movingly at Aaron's funeral. He loved Aaron and was just devastated by this. So The one thing that he wrote in his piece, which I think the title is "Prosecutor as Bully," is that right?
Yes, it is, and it's a very strong piece. I agree. And Lawrence has played very good role, and he just says the prosecutors were outrageous in this case. Is really what he says.
Yeah, which is completely right. I mean, 99% of what he wrote in that piece, I would absolutely agree with. He did write one thing, which was that he felt that. I think he felt that Aaron's case was legally strong, and he wrote that. You know, it is partly Aaron's fault that we got to this point of these charges, because what he did was, if not legally wrong, at least morally wrong. And I think he felt that sneaking into a network closet or violating some copyrights, which it may be the case that Aaron did, although I think a lot of those articles were it was legitimate to copy them. It was more a terms of service thing, but I don't know the details there. He felt that Aaron should have acted within the bounds of the law, or more within the bounds of the law and of perhaps the rights of property owners. I don't know exactly what he was getting at, but he felt that Aaron had not acted entirely defensively in how he got access to the articles. And I don't agree with. I don't see anything morally wrong with what Aaron was doing. I wrote that I thought there might have been something legally wrong with it. It's a bad law, you know, when you violate a bad law, then yes, you've done something illegal, but you might also have done something right. Although after the defense attorney spoke at the funeral and gave some more details, and I had read some more about the case, particularly Alex Stamos's piece, I now think that even legally he was on pretty solid ground. I mean, I think he might have just completely won the case, and it's clear that his defense attorney thought they had a very good case. But I don't think there was anything morally wrong, and I don't know how strongly Lessig feels that. I mean, he probably was disappointed with the kind of sneaky way that Aaron went about getting access to this particular large trove of data. But I don't think even Lessig would have called it a major moral transgression, if a transgression at all.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Carl Fogel, a colleague of Aaron Swartz, who last week committed suicide. Carl, I want to spend just the last couple minutes with you on really two things. One is, you knew Aaron, and if you feel comfortable to give us some of your thoughts about your relationship with Aaron, what he was like.
Yeah, I will. Not that I... there were many, many people who knew him better. I knew him socially... actually, we first met socially, not through a collaboration about, you know, copyright reform or anything. And then a little bit professionally, we would meet at conferences and collaborate on certain things and correspond about colleagues by email, just to keep each other clued in on who was, you know, who was good to work with, who did you have to watch out for certain aspects of their work style or whatever. He was incredibly engaging as a conversationalist, and not—I mean—the stereotype of the young prodigy, which he truly was a prodigy. And I want to emphasize that the things your listeners might be reading or hearing about him in the past few days are not just eulogizing and hagiography post facto. He really was all that. And if you'd asked all these people 6 months ago, tell me about Aaron Swartz, everyone would have said the same things they're saying now. He had read a lot, had talked to a lot of people, followed politics very closely, and not just politics around freedom of information, politics in general. The stereotype of the young prodigy is that they think they know it all, and that they want to talk and they might say interesting things, but that they can't listen. He absolutely didn't fit that. He was a very good listener, and when you said something that he hadn't thought of, which might be rare because he thought a lot, he would really pause for a moment and say, you know, okay, that's That's right. And then he would instantly integrate that new and unexpected fact, perhaps contradictory to something he had previously believed, into everything he knew. And somehow his entire approach would sort of change very quickly. And he would be having a different conversation because he had figured out how that new piece affects everything else that he already believed. He was just an amazingly quick and deep mind. His intellectual capacity was is talked about a lot. Emotionally, he allowed his infectiousness and his enthusiasms to show with a lot of people. I think his quieter thoughts and more introspective side, he did show it to closer friends. I wasn't one of those friends. And we didn't have conversations about any of the darker things in his life. But I know that there were people he talked to about it. He was not without friends.
I know you were at the funeral yesterday. Can you describe your emotions and what the family said about Aaron?
His family, I they're devastated. I'll leave it at that. It was hard.
We don't have to say anymore, really. I mean, I knew Aaron a little bit and was just completely devastated. So.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that struck me the most was how many people loved him a lot. And, that's all I think people need to know.
Thank you, Carl. And going forward, I know people are, apart from wanting to reform the law and get rid of the U.S. attorneys, there's also other things going on. There's like people are uploading documents and then saying we have to carry on Aaron's work. And
I mean, I think there's a sense in which everyone who knew him or knew of his work is sort of WWAD, what would Aaron do, is sort of a question, a signpost that will remain in our minds for a long time, hopefully for the rest of our lives. There have been a lot of wonderful pieces posted just in the last couple of days about actions that people want to take. I just read, just before our call, a good editorial in the Yale Daily News by Adi Kamdar, saying that the particular thing that he wants to do and is doing in this editorial is pressing the Yale faculty, the professors, to say, well, why aren't you taking the initiative and asking the administration to make Yale an open access school in terms of the faculty's own publications? Why as institutions of higher learning are we not in the forefront of making sure that anyone anywhere can get access to the research and the knowledge that we are producing and organizing? And I thought that was a great editorial and one that could have been run at any of thousands of schools around the world. It's a question that everyone who works in the field of accumulating and producing and organizing knowledge should ask themselves. During another conversation about Aaron that someone asked recently was, do you think that this, what happened and the charges that he faced will scare other people who might be tempted into doing similar, who might otherwise have been tempted to do similar things where they sort of use technical means to liberate knowledge that really deserves to be liberated? And I said then that I feared that it would cause people to have second thoughts and to worry. And I hope that I'm wrong about that. I hope that people that look at this and say, essentially, we're all Aaron. There's no reason to fear those who would criminalize an attempt to share knowledge, and that we should all try to do it. We should not be afraid. We shouldn't be afraid to take actions they might be illegal in the sense that the law has outsourced itself to a private website operator's terms of service, but they're not illegal in the broader human law. I mean, humans should be sharing knowledge, and that comes first. The penalties shouldn't scare us. I'm sorry, that wasn't very eloquent, but...
No, that was very, very beautiful, Carl.
Thank you, Carl.
We really appreciate it, and I do want to send, and I think this is the right website for reading what Carl has written about Aaron Swartz, as well as about a lot of these issues. I think it's questioncopyright.org.
That is right. Thank you. And that the front page right now is a piece, an obituary for Aaron, and it links to some other good pieces, and I will update as other pieces come out. So I think following through that article, some of the links might also be worth reading.
It's a very strong piece, and I really appreciate your writing it, and appreciate your being with us, Carl. Thank you very much.
Thanks for appreciating the importance of Aaron's life and his work. Thank you.
Thank you, Carl.
Michael, last week you attended the 85th birthday of Ramsey Clark. It's hard for me to believe. I was in law school when Ramsey Clark was appointed by President Johnson as Attorney General of the United States. He was in his 30s, I, of course, in my 20s, and his father was on the Supreme Court, Tom Clark. He was on the Supreme Court and was required to resign because Ramsey, as Attorney General, would have to argue many cases, or many of the cases would come before the Supreme Court, and Tom Clark would have to disqualify himself. So Ramsey's appointed Attorney General. I don't know what I thought at the time, whether it was a moderate appointment. He wasn't known as a particularly radical person then. Of course, he now has become a huge champion of, you know, the best of the causes, the best of the progressive causes in the world. But back then, the height of the Vietnam War, and this guy's Attorney General. What's he going to do, prosecute a bunch of us who were draft resistors? So you went to the 85th birthday. I guess he's come a long way since then. You and I haven't come that far, but he went a little farther.
I have to say, I haven't changed much in many years, Michael, and neither have you. And Ramsey changed pretty quick. I mean, Ramsey was from that missing generation, remember. He served in World War II towards the end of the war, and then he went to the University of Chicago, where he was influenced and politicized by Robert Hutchins, who was then the president of the University of Chicago. It's not the reactionary place that we know about today. The University of Chicago was much different then, and it affected Ramsey. He got his law degree and his degree in history all in about 2 years. He was an amazing student. But we've interviewed him about that, and we'll link to it on lawanddisorder.org. In any case, there were about 300 people at Ramsey's birthday party.
Wow.
Up at Riverside Church. He gave just the most wonderful short talk after a number of speakers had spoken about him, which we will play for our audience. But I just wanted to make some observations about Ramsey. At 85, tomorrow, he's leaving and flying to Vietnam.
That's amazing. Incredible. At 85, and I know you represented him after an accident, and he had trouble walking for a short while. And
he's no spring chicken.
Right, and he's going off to Vietnam.
And he's
going
to sit in an airplane for however long it takes to fly halfway around the world. Why? Because it's the 40th anniversary of the Paris Peace Accords, which led to the ultimate defeat and withdrawal of the United States from Vietnam.
Does anybody younger than us remember the Paris Peace Accords? Well, tell us what they were, Michael.
United States was systematically trying to destroy not only the people of Vietnam, and they killed several million, but really the country. With the Agent Orange and defoliating the countryside, they were going to turn that place into the surface of the moon unless the Vietnamese gave up the naive idea of independence. And Ramsey quickly understood that. And he told me a wonderful story about the cabinet meeting that he attended as Attorney General. He was part of Lyndon Johnson's cabinet. And he went to a meeting, told Johnson and the cabinet that he opposed the war in Vietnam. Well, that was the last cabinet meeting that Ramsey Clark was ever invited to. And he served out his term and became really a champion of what I would call the rule of law. I think that's Ramsey's guiding light, that he believes in the rule of law, as we all do. And he'll take cases all over the world to champion that position. And go anywhere, like Vietnam, or I remember I went out to see Jim Lafferty. Lafferty had organized something, and Ramsey Clark was going to speak out in Michigan. I was out there a couple weeks after Jim and Bonnie put me on the couch in the living room, and Jim said, "Should be good enough for you. It was good enough for Ramsey Clark." Now, here's the former Attorney General, son of a Supreme Court justice, traveling out to Michigan, sleeping on a couch.
He's amazing.
That's what Ramsey is, a very modest, lovely, kind man.
Margie Ratner and I represent him when he did another, you know, these are typical, as you said, he goes all over the world. During the height of the hostage crisis in Iran in 1979, he travels to Iran.
Yeah.
And to try and, like, figure out how to really, I guess, have people released, but to lessen the tensions. And they were going to look at him under a criminal statute called the Logan Act that is on the books and prohibits private people from trying to do diplomacy on behalf of the United States. Now, they've never successfully prosecuted anybody, but I remember Margie and I looking up the Logan Act because they were going to go after Ramsey. He was looked at like a complete traitor for going to Iran, you know, during that period.
Yeah, you know, still is by the establishment, because the truth is, he's a traitor.
Michael, he one time, represents one the time, best of America.
One time, Zhou Enlai, who was the leader of the Communist Party in China years ago, and he came from an aristocratic family in China, and a newspaper reporter accused him of being a traitor to his class, and Zhou Enlai said, yes, that's true. And I think that's true of Ramsey also. Good for Ramsey. Anyway, I wanted to talk a bit about Ramsey's understanding of what was going on in Vietnam and why he turned against the war, because it's really the same thing that's going on now with the French and American support in subjugating the people of Mali. You follow the dollar. Mali and that whole region around it in northern Africa is the center for uranium mining. 75% of French electricity comes from nuclear-powered generators. The French want to hold on to that nuclear power in the same way that in Vietnam, I remember Eisenhower clearly articulating American objectives in trying to crush the Vietnamese independence movement. And he said, why? Because that's a very rich country full of rice, tin, tungsten, rubber, and the United States wanted to make sure that Vietnam wasn't going to succeed in gaining its independence. They intervened in 1954, just like they're intervening now 59 years later by supporting the French in Mali. And what was it that Ramsey contributed to in the anti-war movement? The notion that the United States had no business in Vietnam, that the Vietnamese were entitled to their self-determination, and the United States should get its troops out now. And how was that done? The anti-war movement was done in the same way that the civil rights movement was organized. And Ramsey was down south and saw it unfurl and knew Martin Luther King, that it was done in the streets, independent of the Democratic Party, by people making demands on the government. And that's the same way the anti-war movement was organized. It started out in 1965 with the first March on Washington of 20,000 people. We all thought that was fantastic. And the height of the Cold War was still going on, and you had 20,000 people come out in the streets in support of getting out of Vietnam and really defying the government's anti-communism. That movement succeeded within 8 years of building. The demonstration 4 years later in 1969 was 500,000 people. And it succeeded in reaching out to GIs who were fighting over there. The Vietnamese were the main reason that the United States lost the war, because of the Vietnamese resistance. But the other reason was that the United States Army wouldn't fight in Vietnam anymore. They were very much influenced by the mass civilian anti-war movement. And this unfolded, and 8 years after that 20,000 person march on Washington that started it all off, by 1973, the United States packed up and left. And Ramsey was a supporter of that movement and continued to support independent political action in the streets for justice in this country and around the world.
Even on some cases when I've disagreed with him, he's been a hero for absolutely ever. I mean, he takes the position, and I think it's an important one to understand, that the U.S. should not be enforcing any kind of human rights norms anywhere in the world as the greatest purveyor of violence of any country in the world. And he takes that down the line. So even in the case where I might sue a really bad guy, or a person I perceive as a bad guy, he would say, if you're doing it on behalf of the U.S., you shouldn't be doing it, Michael. So we have our disagreements, but they're mild compared to our overall understanding of the role of the United States as the major imperialist power that will crush any people's movements under its heel and do it every day and every year and every decade.
So happy birthday, Ramsey Clark. We're going to go now to the short talk that Ramsey gave at his birthday party in January at Riverside Church in New York City. Ramsey, you've got the stage.
Well, thank you very much. I'm a little embarrassed, but not being very modest, I can stand it. Been through worse ordeals, but I don't really remember when offhand. I never have heard so many speeches that I couldn't find a credible word in. But it's nice to be here. Remember, Lincoln met a guy on a road outside of Springfield, just been tarred and feathered, and he asked me how it felt, and the guy said, well, except the honor of it, I'd just sooner walked. I know exactly how he felt. There's just not enough time. It'd take me to Monday morning to rebut all the false allegations that have been made about me. Put myself on the country and let them be the judge. I want to talk briefly about one thing, but before I do, I want to say something special about Hugo Chavez. He's one of the great leaders of our time. If a person doesn't have heroes, he's got a complex that's not healthy. And Hugo Chavez has a hero, and you can't talk with him for 5 minutes if he doesn't mention Simón Bolívar, the great liberator. But I'm a history buff and student, and I can assure you that Hugo Chavez has liberated more people in more countries. Of course, there's a lot more people to liberate than when Simón Bolívar was around, but than Simón Bolívar could have ever counted. The service that he's provided for the poor in Latin America, the political freedom he's given to half a dozen countries that were struggling against the domination of their bully neighbor to the north, unprecedented in the history of this hemisphere. And maybe the rest of the hemispheres. How many are there? What I do want to talk about was raised on April the 4th, 1967 here by Martin Luther King in this church, 1 year to the day before he was murdered. And what he said hurt him terribly. He sent me a note I still treasure and a copy of the speech. He wanted to be sure I got it right, what he really said, that how hard it was for him to say what he did, but it was that my own country is the greatest purveyor of violence on earth. He gave his life to change that. Violence couldn't stand a man that believed that way. But the violence that's now pervaded exceeds anything that the world has known. And we have to do everything within our power as individuals and collectively to stop it. In the last 2 years, and I'll just give two illustrations. I've been in three trials. I think they're the only trials as an expert witness, not as a... They didn't use lawyers. These were basically Catholic radicals who don't like violence, don't hate anything, but don't like war, for sure. And they were trying to, by putting their bodies on the line at air bases in the United States where the decision to fire drones were made. In each of the trials, it became so clear, and it was interesting to watch the difficulty of even hardened judges in hearing the evidence. But here, these men just outside of Syracuse and on an air base, and 40 miles north of Las Vegas on an air base. They're pilots. Because somebody had the idea that pilots would have a better instinct as to when to punch the button. And they're watching a screen, and it's got shadowy pictures of a highway or whatever it happens to be, and a truck coming down to it. They're waiting to see at the right moment to punch the button to fire the missile to destroy who's ever in that truck, how many thousands of miles away, halfway around the world, generally. The idea that you can assassinate people around the world without their ability to even know that they're in danger. They may think they're safe when they're sleeping at home in their bed. And on what evidence? And the president himself says he makes the decision. What's his decision worth? No decision is worth more than the evidence or information on which it's based. And what does he know? He knows what the CIA tells him, you know. I can tell you that when I was in the government, I had Helms, who was the head of the CIA, and Houston, who was his top counsel, come in and lie to me in the face about whether it's some planes that, on an air base, not an air base, a public airport in Buffalo, New York, were CIA or not. He said they weren't. than they were. Would they not say that to the president? But even if they would, you read our Constitution, and if you think we would ever fall to the level that we would assassinate someone who we suspected, and we thought this shadowy person might be him, and we didn't care who the half dozen others in the vehicle were, or didn't know who else was in the house, and yet we'd kill them all. The people that will tolerate that are in trouble. And we're the people. We have to try to put an end to it. The other thing is what we've done with nuclear arms. We've got a machine that can take out the biggest country in the world, can take out the continent, perhaps. It's called the Trident II nuclear submarine. And the evidence that we obtained, and you have to presume it's the least damaging presentation that could have been made by the government, is that this was a Pacific fleet, specific Trident II nuclear fleet. 30 subs, that doesn't sound like too many. They're big monsters, so they're a lot bigger around than this room, and they're 400 feet long. They carry normally 140 nuclear warheads and missiles. They only have two calibers. The smallest caliber is about 12 times that of the bomb that incinerated Hiroshima and Belleville. The bigger one leaves a crater, they say. What do I know? They say 50 miles in diameter. Imagine trying to find a point around the metropolitan area where we are right now in which you would detonate the bomb to kill the largest population, and that's just in the crater. That doesn't include what gets caught up in the blast that goes out from there. You kill 25 million people, and imagine one ship with 140 warheads like that. Try and think of 140 cities in Europe. I think for a long time, think of that many. Think of the biggest ones first, because you're in the business of killing. You have eight of those on alert in the Pacific alone, out at all times. If that's not madness, I don't know what is. How could you use one of those bombs? And you've got 140 at the fingertip of one ship's captain. Attention must be paid, as we've been told. And if we can't act radically and quickly to turn that around, to slash our military budget by 80%, put in food for people who are hungry and starving, and all the things that are needed around the world and here, stop our assault on the environment, which is getting angry with us. And you or I would be too if we were treated that way. So while we know that organizations like the IAC and great and imaginative leaders like Hugo Chavez have done great deeds for people, we have an unprecedented challenge and must engage it and pursue it the miles that we have before we sleep. Thanks so much for helping me celebrate my non-birthday.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.